Who cares about biomechanics? Just lift hard, bro. You're overcomplicating the simple stuff.
Biomechanics as a sort of underlying reality to exercise is kind of like, I don't know, macronutrient, micronutrient is to food. It's like, okay, I'm going to eat this apple. I'm going to eat this candy bar. I can eat the apple or the candy bar to gain some calories, right? But like an understanding of what's in the apple, what's in the candy bar, that is always going to allow you to, within any circumstance, make more appropriate decisions based on where you're at. So it's either, you know what's in the apple and you know what's in the candy bar, or you don't. And while certainly many people can achieve great results not understanding what the word torque means or what a moment arm is or, you know, how these concepts relate to the human body, it certainly doesn't hurt. And in my personal experience, it certainly seems to help much more than it hurts. I'm not a huge fan of the idea generally that ignorance is bliss. And I think that especially when, you know, we're training ourselves and, you know, if you're a trainer or a coach, you're working with other people, I think we have some responsibility to kind of take on at least a little bit of that understanding of like, hey, what's going on in here? You know, it's kind of like we get one of these things, you know, unlike the apple or the candy bar. It's like I can have an apple now and a candy bar later. But I think just creating some level of understanding of nutrition in that context is incredibly helpful. And that's kind of what you see on average across people who, you know, like yourself, are successful in the physique department, successful in the sort of energetic department, where they feel alive, they feel energized. So overall, I don't think that ignorance is bliss. And I certainly don't see people who do understand biomechanics moving backward, right? At the very least, they're staying the same or they're getting better. So that's kind of where my mind goes with that, not necessarily question, but strong statement.
Interesting with that ignorance is bliss, because you could argue that the person that doesn't know better can just attack their workouts with this animalistic aggression because they've got no perceived limits on what they can do.
Yeah, I think that. And maybe this is kind of connects to the first part of my answer, which is like, I'm certainly not old now. I'm very aware of that. And I think it's hilarious when people who are in their mid late 20s talk about how, you know, their joints are getting creaky or something like that. But when I was younger, I certainly could notice in myself that like I could just 6 days a week, 2 to 3 hours a day, you know, I'm in college, I got nothing better to do. I can just beat myself to shreds. And it's like, even if I, you know, back when I would hurt my low back or hurt my pecs, which I think maybe in certain contexts will connect to our discussion today, I could just recover like pretty easily from those things. And it is really shocking to me the amount that younger people can do in terms of just the pure amount of volume, the pure amount of just slapping more weight on the bar when more weight isn't warranted or could potentially be a bad thing. So, you know, in my experience, it's like people definitely learn one way or another. And I definitely don't subscribe to the idea that people need to get to the point of destroying, you know, half the joints in their body to be able to start learning. I think it can really just be a matter of interest and curiosity.
Very true. The ones that I see in the game for the longest that have developed the best physique, the most strength, they tend to be the ones that have been consistent long enough, had as few injuries during their journey to be able to get them to that point. And the just go hard, bro, just train hard all the time tends to be from the lifters that have had less than 5 years experience.
Yeah. And I also think it's, I think that's definitely true. I definitely think there is that subset of like dedicated meatheads who are, you know, 40, 50, 60 years old, who just like, they're, you know, they're limping into the gym and they just don't, they're just like, screw it, I'm just going to run this thing into the ground. But I think it's fair to say that anyone who's really thinking about the problem would say, okay, that's probably a suboptimal approach, you know, to lifting. So, I think that it kind of reminds me of the discussion around, you know, volume and intensity. It's kind of like, when we talk about volume and intensity, volume, you know, as measured by, okay, how many sets are we doing every week? Intensity maybe being measured as effort, or in the context of powerlifting, how much load you're using. People kind of talk about those things as if there's kind of like a distinction between them, right? As if you could do a set of 10 call it volume without also talking about intensity. So it's like, you know, if we're going to drive this car pretty hard, we're not going to be able to do it for super long. And if we're going to drive it for super long distances, it's probably wise to kind of take the tortoise approach. And I think that the younger that you can realize that, the better. And I think we're kind of moving away from this glorification of, you know, the good old days where people think that it's kind of like a rite of passage to have a shoulder that doesn't work by the time you're 35.
Most definitely. And as you'll see with this conversation, it's not one or the other. You don't have to be the absolute meathead that doesn't know anything about technique and joint torque and forces, etc. But you also don't have to be the one that's just studying on PubMed all day, skipping training sessions because you want to be on PubMed to learn more. Having this element of both gives you the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and not only that, I would almost even go a step further, at least in my own experience. And I've also worked with people who are, you know, in the IFBB, people who are doing this thing at the highest levels, both personally and also just through, you know, online discussion and so forth. And it seems to me that knowledge and effort as it relates to the gym are synergistic, right? It's like you learn more so that you can train harder, so that you can train more safely. It's like the learning ideally opens the door or opens the window to not necessarily more longevity. It's not like bodybuilders are trying to be like the healthiest people in the world, right? But your average person, like the more you know, the more you can put into it, and the less hopefully negative side effects that you can get out of it. And I've certainly found that to be true. In my case, I sort of briefly mentioned it, but I was constantly getting hurt. I was constantly just training through injuries, training around injuries. And that was kind of the initial motivation for me to get into all this stuff to begin with. And, you know, I won't say that I was lucky to be getting hurt all the time, but it certainly was motivation for me to learn a thing or two. And, you know, fingers crossed, I haven't been hurt in, you know, many, many years now. So hopefully that's kind of the trend that I can create for other people, or at least that's my goal.
For sure. The big three barbell movements are the king of all exercises. You have to do them to get big and strong.
I'll stick with the food analogy here because I think it's appropriate. It's kind of like, again, the good old days. It's like, let's just eat our chicken and rice and we'll be healthy. It's not that chicken and rice doesn't work, but many people find chicken and rice to be bland, you know, and in the context of training and specifically training for muscle growth, right? I think like the average person who will be listening to this conversation is not someone who is very likely to be trying to set world records in the deadlift, say. They're the person who wants to look a little hotter, right? Wants to look a little bit more muscular, feel better naked, feel better moving around. And just the idea altogether that one would need to restrict themselves in really any sense as it relates to their gym experience to me is kind of a non-starter, right? It's kind of like saying you can only eat these three foods. It's like, well, there's this other food over here that, you know, kind of has the same quality, kind of gives me a similar, you know, amount of protein, say in the case of the chicken, maybe we go with beef, maybe we go with eggs, maybe we go with whey protein. And ultimately there are so many different ways to skin the cat that reducing your movement options, we'll call it, to me is just a fast track to really just not enjoy what you're doing. And, you know, in a day and age where it's never been easier to just sit on your ass all day and do nothing, that's the last thing that I want to be pushing out, you know, against people. And that kind of connects to, you know, the broader theme of like, what is a barbell doing to your body, right? It's just an input of force, right? In the same way that I'm sitting on this chair and the chair is pushing up against me, right? A barbell is a push against me, or you could think about it as a pull, right? In the case of a deadlift. And so very quickly, like a deadlift could become, you know, a hinge on a machine, or a hinge with dumbbells, or a hinge with cables. A barbell squat could become a leg press. It could become a hack squat, right? It's not to say that there aren't qualitative differences between these things, but ultimately the differences between them should really just come down to what do they do for the person, and how much, you know, does the person enjoy them, and how long can they sustain them?
But Ben, I heard that squats and deadlifts are an exercise that increases testosterone and growth hormone. They're very special in this respect. Is that true?
As far as my understanding goes, no, that is not true. I mean, there seems to be some evidence to indicate that pretty much every kind of, we'll say, exercise that you can do that includes large swaths of muscle recruitment leads to those things over longer periods of time, right? And you're giving me the thumbs up there, so that's a good sign. You know, this is not a world I'm particularly invested in. But again, it's just like, if you just break it down to the fundamental unit of the thing, like, what is the difference? Does your body know the difference between, you know, a bar on your back and, you know, the floor, which is pushing up against you, or like, you know, a pad on a machine? It's like, it's kind of when you break it down that way, it kind of becomes much more clear how ridiculous the notion is to begin with. And just, you know, personally speaking, I would rather have a nice comfy, you know, pad, you know, kind of like I'm, you know, in a recliner chair, right, rather than a hard wooden chair on my back. But, you know, maybe you like the pain of a rusty barbell, rub it up against your traps.
It's the hardcore element. If you're not using a barbell, you're an absolute pussy. And that's the school of thought that I came up with in the early 2010s. And it really limited me, because you need to think for yourself, what is my goal with doing the squat, bench press, deadlift? If you're competing in powerlifting, those are the lifts that you get measured on in terms of your success. You've got to do them. Specificity is king. So you have to do those lifts to get better at them and also compete. But then you look at your own training. I just want to build well-rounded strength. I want to build some muscle. You've got a plethora of different exercise options for vertical, horizontal pulling, pushing, squatting, hinging with machines, with free weights that could be dumbbells, barbells, as you said, just more options there. So not being as dogmatic can really open your eyes to your other options that you have.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of the reason, and it connects to our earlier conversation about how people end up in places where their joints just feel like garbage. It's like they're doing things that they're not comfortable doing solely because someone who maybe is more experienced than them, maybe who has had more success than them with these particular movements said, hey, this is the thing to do. And just like you said, it's like if you want to get good at those things, by all means, you know, go for it. And by the way, if you enjoy those things, by all means, go for it. It's just kind of like, you know, for me, I don't know why, but the example that came to mind is like, you ever seen those Nathan's hot dog eating contests?
I have, yes. If you're being exposed to American culture, this is going to give you an idea of what you guys get up to up there.
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I am super invested in this, but like, if you want to get really good at eating 100 hot dogs in, you know, 15 minutes or whatever the time frame is, you got to practice eating the hot dogs.
You got to break them in half. You need to ingest water at the same time. It's not really eating food at that stage.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I don't want to compare barbells to hot dogs, right? But in a sense, I think it's a kind of a appropriate analogy. And I would liken it in the sense that people do in the same way attach themselves to specific implements in the gym, much like with foods. That just is such an appropriate analogy and accessible analogy to use. And I think it's just helpful to know one. So, you know, short version of that is you enjoy the barbell or you need to do it for sport. Go ahead. If you don't, you should feel no attachment to it.
Yeah, and it's the whole, especially with the barbell squat, this is a great example where if your anthropometry, your joint angles, limb lengths, proportions suit the particular style of squat you're doing, it'll feel great. Some people really connect well with the high bar squat based on their femur lengths to torso and the tibia length as well. For other people, it's going to be an absolute nightmare, if not impossible to do. And that is where the restriction comes in with a barbell, because you have less variability with how you can do the movement pattern, the squat pattern. You could do it on different types of machines and be able to get the stimulus through your lower body, because it actually suits the angle of your hips and those proportions, as I said.
Yeah, and I think it's important to, you know, make sure that people know that it is a perfectly fine option, and that you know, they should keep doing it if they like it. But you know, to your point, it is really a matter of having to balance over your feet versus not, right? It's like the constraint for a lot of people ends up being, I don't want to fall backward, I don't want to fall forward, right? But you know, you put your feet on a leg press, it's like that leg press isn't going anywhere. You put your feet high, you put your feet low, even something like a Smith machine, right? Even though a Smith machine is in essence is a barbell, right? Because of the fact that it is in itself constrained, right? It's effectively immovable. You can move your feet forward, you can move them backward, you can move them wide, you can move them narrow. And you know, there's literally no risk in doing that, and just being able to kind of make those micro adjustments. And so I kind of like to, the description I like to give in relation to machines versus something like a barbell when it comes to the squat pattern is just that initially people think that because machines are more constrained, right, because they're more guided, that therefore will create more restriction. It actually creates more freedom, right? Because now all of a sudden you're not constricted by things like limb length and balance. You're actually just constrained to however you push into the machine, which I think is a fantastic thing. And I think it relates closely to, again, this glorification of the past, where when we eventually develop machines, which I think we will at some point, that just feels so immediately good for so many people, people are going to start to realize very, very quickly just how beneficial the use of machines is. And a lot of this sort of idea around the mysticism and the magical barbell, I think that will just become less and less of a thing over time, or at least I really hope that it does.
I agree. And it's also that accessibility piece to barbells are so cheap and easy to get for your home gym setup. Every commercial gym has one. The cost of getting these specialty type of equipment, it's significantly more. So I think that might be another contributing factor as to why it's been such a mainstay as an exercise staple.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also why I try to provide as many kind of what we'll call them non-traditional alternatives with free weight exercises, right? It's like even something as simple as, instead of having 2 feet in a barbell squat, right, you put a barbell on your back and now all of a sudden maybe you stagger your stance. It's like simply just the fact that you've now staggered your stance gives you so much more room to move back and forth, right? It's like for people listening, the way you can think about it is, moving your feet in a sort of front to back stagger is just creating essentially a wider platform underneath of you, right? So in some sense, it becomes a little more difficult to coordinate, but once you get the movement down, it's like, okay, I can shift my knee really far forward. I can make it more of a quad thing. I can maybe sit a little bit backward, make it more of a hip dominant thing. And so even just those options that, you know, stay free weight, but that are, again, quote unquote, non-traditional based on what people's sort of expectations are, those can just free up so many different options for people that, again, are, you know, don't possess this same kind of weight to them in terms of the historical significance, right? But that are clearly equally as effective, equally as stimulative, and potentially for many people more stimulative at the end of the day.
Yeah, man, 100%. How about you need to feel a muscle working during an exercise, the whole mind-muscle connection train of thought?
So for those who maybe are less familiar, I think that the mind-muscle connection really originated as something super powerful and relevant from bodybuilding, right? Much in the same way that squat, bench, deadlift became prevalent because of sport like powerlifting. It's like bodybuilders forever have been saying, you gotta get the squeeze, right? Arnold, it's like, the pump, it's as good as sex, right? If you don't get it, like, you're just wasting your time. I think there's obviously something to that, right? Like if I'm doing a leg extension and my hamstrings are on fire, it's like, okay, something is amiss, right? It's only when the logic of that initial thought of I need to be feeling the muscle takes people away from putting in effort to the exercise, loading it up appropriately, right, progressing it longer term. It's only when that sort of takes place that I start to think that it's more of a concern, right? And the sort of flip side of this, or maybe not the flip side, but an example, is like, if you see someone doing, you know, say, let's just call it a single arm pull down, right? And they're moving at like speeds that you can barely observe, you know, how much they're moving because of how slow they're moving and how much they're squeezing their lat, let's say, you know, and you take a look at the cable stack and it's like, there's 2.5 pounds on the cable stack. You're looking at like a 200 pound guy doing the pull down. Okay. That's probably something probably needs to be changed, you know, about that. Right. But on the flip side, it's like, you also don't want to be the guy who's just toss and turn in, like mind paid to anything technical or anything careful, no attention to detail in terms of the quality of the exercise. That is also bad. So I think it's safe to say that, like, if the correct muscle that you're trying to target isn't fatiguing, if you don't feel it at all, we'll raise, you know, a red flag about that. But if you're kind of sort of feeling it, you're not exactly sure what's happening, but like, you know that the physics of the movement are going to dictate, say on a leg extension, that your quads are going to be the thing to do the exercise. It's like, okay, we really don't need to overthink this. And that's why I think like a physics first approach is so important. It's not that everyone needs to have a PhD in physics, but I don't really need to wonder what's doing the moving on a leg extension, right? I know that my quads are going to be the only thing to do it unless I'm flopping around all over the place, you know, like a dead fish or something. So mind-muscle connection, important, but also needs to be contextualized to what the end result of that product sort of needs to be.
Where the confusion comes in is generally on compound exercises, where it's multi-joint, multi-muscle, and especially if you're playing with lower rep ranges, you can finish a set and just feel systemically fatigued just generally, but not having any one area worked. And if you're a beginner new to exercise, this is the common question that is asked to personal trainers: where should I be feeling this exercise? It's, bro, if you get heavier on this compound lift and progressive overload in 6 months, it doesn't matter where you're feeling it. You're going to grow those muscles that are involved in the movement pattern.
Yeah. So I'm laughing because in my experience as a personal trainer, I have made the mistake of asking that question probably too many times.
Why do you think I was able to say it as well, Ben?
And it's just like, why would I expect this person who started resistance training last week to know exactly what they're feeling? It's like, people who are like physically fit just become more and more detached from that reality of just having no concept of like, so, and that's a really great point. I think to the specific example that you brought up, I think it's good to know that in these more, we'll call them compound exercises, we'll say, and again, somewhat of an arbitrary definition, but we'll say a compound exercise is an exercise that, you know, can sort of primarily recruit, I don't know, 3 or more muscle groups, right? So take a barbell back squat, we'll call it quads, adductors, glutes, and erectors, right? We'll call those the main sort of drivers, right? If the back squat isn't super localized to any one of those, but all you feel is a kind of tremendous pressure, right? That to me seems like an appropriate thing, right? But to my points earlier, like, you're doing something that should be isolated in its effect. You're feeling all these things in a way that makes it feel compound. Then it starts to become something that I would want to look at more specifically and try to troubleshoot. But if you ask any powerlifter, if you ask any high level sprinter, for example, like, hey, what do you feel when you're under this incredibly heavy bar? They're just going to say something like pressure, right? It's all just pressure. And I think that is a little bit of like a safety mechanism that the brain creates. It can't explain the neurology behind this or anything, but it's like, it would make sense to me that if your body is concerned about being crushed by a 200 pound bar in your back, right, that the sensation in that particular case would be reduced. And that when you're doing something, say, less systemically demanding, less globally fatiguing, it would make sense that then you would feel that more locally. So always comes down to what you're, you know, ultimately trying to get out of something. But for me personally, I think, and I think we see this generally too now with people kind of learning more about this stuff, the more experienced people tend to become, the less concerned with the particular sensations they tend to be over time, at least in my experience.
Couldn't agree more. And if you're trying to achieve the mind-muscle connection at the expense of high levels of effort, then you're doing yourself a disservice. So that simplicity of just focusing on progressively lifting heavier, working at high RPE, you know, not many reps in reserve, working close to failure within, you know, whatever that means to you on an exercise, don't compare yourself to someone else, then you'll be absolutely sweet. You won't have to overthink this mind-muscle connection, because by using sound technique and sufficient intensity, it'll all take care of itself.
Yeah, and I also would say to that point specifically, that I think it would be a great idea for people to reconceptualize this idea of mind-muscle connection, not as something that you yourself are the arbiter of. In other words, like, you are not what creates a biceps contraction, right? You are not in control of that, as weird as that sounds, right? It's like, if I pick up a dumbbell, right, and I start doing curls, there's no world in which I'm choosing my biceps to, or making my biceps contract. They just do. And so this kind of, I try to explain this a lot, because I think it's a great question, or it's an important sort of myth to bust, that it's not really like a mind muscle thing, in terms of when we're talking about muscle contraction. I don't view muscle contraction as something we actually create. I actually view it as a response to whatever forces we need to deal with, and whatever forces we need to deal with relative to whatever position we're in, right? So again, just simple example, if I'm doing a curl, it's like, I'm just putting my body in a position and I'm using a resistance so that my biceps contract. It's the last thing in the sequence to occur. So if you're not feeling the right things, it's not that your body is malfunctioning, right? The brain, trust me, is way, way smarter than we are. The brain knows what's going on. The brain knows what to do. If you're feeling the wrong things, it means there's something about the exercise from a physical perspective that you need to change.
I'm glad you said that. This is what brings home the merit of biomechanics and sound technique, because you're doing a bicep curl. Let's just say an extreme example. You think that the best way to do the bicep curl is to have your arm straight and lift it up towards head height. Now, biceps are a shoulder flexor too, but no one's ever doing curls like that. If you're doing elbow flexion, you're training your bicep. You don't have to additionally think, squeeze the bicep. If you're doing the correct movement pattern with that effort, you're saying that you're going to get all the muscle tension, mechanical tension there, and tissue response that you want building muscle.
Yeah, and one more thing to add to that, it's a great point, is that, and this will be sort of an example actually that people can do as they're listening. So what I do commonly is, like, if you make a muscle, it's like the classic like back double bicep thing, you squeeze your bicep, you'll feel everything that's going on there, right? If you have the ability to kind of call upon that. But what you'll notice when you do that is you kind of poke your triceps as you do that. You actually need to create tension on the opposite side of the joint for your biceps to contract, right? So if you squeeze your biceps against nothing, it's like what the biceps are resisting is your triceps, right? It's like if you just make the muscle, boom, you got biceps, triceps. But all of a sudden, if you say, take your hand and you put it under like a table in front of you and you curl up against that table, right? All of a sudden, your biceps have something to act against. And that's what the whole purpose of using external loads is, right? It's like we're giving ourselves things to act against. So we don't need to do the squeezing thing. And in the case of the biceps curl, like if we are doing the squeezing thing, well, what we're actually doing is we're actually creating more antagonistic contribution to the motion, right? So it actually ends up for a lot of people being counterproductive, which to our earlier conversation, I think is a lot of times why people end up using really, really light loads and moving very slowly, is because by definition, you actually can't move that much load if you're essentially fighting yourself, right, during any of these exercises.
This episode is sponsored by Fitness FAQs. Become a bodyweight beast with our calisthenics workouts. Use the coupon code PODCAST10 at checkout to save 10% off when shopping at fitnessfaqs.com. Don't miss this discount. Start training smarter and enjoy the gains. All right, next up, bodybuilding training is non-functional for everyday life.
Oh, man. I mean, when this one comes up, it's more just, am I, I wish that I had someone in front of me to be like, okay, what do you mean by functional, right? Do you mean like, is bodybuilding training not great for like being at the circus and being able to jump around and balance on one leg and balance on, you know, whatever those wires are in Cirque du Soleil where they balance on that one foot at a time. Is bodybuilding training functional for that? More than likely, probably not, right? At least at the extreme, right? Is building muscle in general, building strength in general, building connective tissue strength, getting your tendons stronger, getting your ligaments stronger, right? Creating these fluid shifts in your joint. Is that functional for any activity? Like, absolutely. Right? It's like movement is movement. And again, you know, all these things are going to connect in some way, I think, because ultimately we're just talking about the body here. It's like, I don't really need to do any math to understand that if I improve my ability to move, I grow muscle, I get stronger. That's probably about the only thing that is going to have carryover to literally every other walk of life. Unless, again, you're someone who's 250, 300 pounds, and you have sub 5% body fat, right? Which is like such a small fraction of the population. And it's, I think that conversation gets confused because people look at high-level bodybuilders and they say, oh, look at all these things that these guys can't do. And it's like, well, it wasn't because of the resistance training, at least more than likely. It's probably because of the fact that like these are human Martians, basically, who are walking around at literally inhuman body fat to muscle ratio percentages. So I think in a sort of painful irony, that is a bodybuilding kind of approach, whatever you think of that as, like a resistance training approach, is just about the most functional thing that one could really do for their overall well-being, right? Physically, the physical obviously connects to the cognitive. And again, that doesn't necessarily have to be a firm line, right? So for example, calisthenics, right? You're obviously well-known for the calisthenics stuff. Plenty of bodybuilders do pull-ups, right, in their training. Plenty of bodybuilders towards, say, the end of a chest session, they do body weight dips, they do body weight push-ups, right, drop sets, right, all these crazy things. So you don't like just see bodybuilders that are unable to do these other kinds of resistance training activities, right? You just see them as people who are more muscular than anyone else on earth. And again, to me, that has nothing really directly to do with the way that they're training, but more so the magnitude of effect of, you know, the outcomes of all the things that are, you know, involved in bodybuilding, which obviously include things that are not just, you know, lifting and eating, right? We have this whole sort of pharmacological aspect to it that I think really muddies the water and confuses people about what's going on there.
What I would add additionally to that, in terms of the hierarchy of importance of what is actually functional for human beings, you put having sufficient muscle up there, because as we get older, sarcopenia sets in, and the more muscle mass that you have, the more you've got to lose as you become into your 80s and 90s, if you're lucky to live long enough. Next up would probably be cardio. In terms of all-cause mortality risks, having a healthier functioning heart and circulatory system is really helpful. This might catch me some flack, but probably the least functional one is flexibility, mobility. If you're training for these attributes and you think that being able to do the side splits, front splits, pancake, back bend is going to make you live longer, that's probably one of the biggest myths in the fitness industry. If you have enough flexibility for your ADLs, are you able to sit on the toilet? Are you able to tie your shoes? That's probably enough flexibility that you need. Now, if you are chasing those flexibility goals for them in and of itself, awesome. I've also done the same thing, but I just think we should prioritize muscle strength and cardio as our most functional things.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that I'm always confused because when people talk about the whole functional idea, they kind of say it as if the demands of like modern life are incredibly high, and
yeah, you got to hunt to get by, you got to sprint, you got to jump.
Yeah, it's like, bro, I don't know about you, but like I walk around, I sit, I stand, I reach to the cupboard, you know, to grab a glass of water or whatever. And I love that you brought up that kind of order of importance, because I also think that And I also love that you said the thing about flexibility, because I couldn't agree more. But I think people also may actually take issue with the whole cardio to muscle thing. And just to cover that briefly, you can't elevate your heart rate to a high enough degree to achieve a cardiovascular stimulus if you don't have the machinery to move your body enough to do so, right? It's like, until we develop a pill, right, that's just the cardio pill, you're going to need to actually sort of strengthen the motor, right, so to speak, to be able to actually drive the boat, right? And then only once we can actually do that can we say walk on an inclined treadmill or just you know, regular walking. Like, regular walking is great for people, and so many people as they age, right, fall risk is a sort of addition to what you mentioned, right? The whole couples with the sarcopenia concept, right? Fall risk is humongous. Not many people really are even aware of that. But as you get older, it's like things just go rapidly downhill from there. If you sustain some kind of hip or knee injury, say, right, when you're unable to actually generate enough of a stimulus to your cardiovascular system to actually, you know, reap those benefits. So I would totally agree with that. But I do also think that people we'll use that as justification, you know, the classic gym bros who think that cardio is going to kill their gains or something like that, which is hilarious to me. You know, I think that really needs to be something that becomes more and more popular, much like these other sort of myths that we've been busting along the way, because I think that actually is something that is tremendously impactful. Like, I don't think that you can overstate the importance of that.
Yeah, having a sufficient level of cardiovascular health doesn't mean you have to go out and run marathons. It just needs to be that minimum threshold. I think it's like 150 minutes a week of moderate physical activity where you're breathing a bit heavy. Same thing goes for your level of range of motion. If it is sufficient for the tasks that are important to you in the gym and also in life, fantastic. If you want to push these further, by all means, go for it. But if we're looking at the function and health side of things in this context, that's where I'd stand with that.
Yeah, and I do think people are surprised to know that flexibility, mobility, whatever word you want to, you know, use to describe that, is so far down on the list of things that are important to overall health. And I do think that, you know, I see people at my gym, for instance, because I go roughly at the same time every day, I'll see people who are in their, what I would guess, 50s, 60s, who spend the first 30 minutes of their session just rolling around on foam objects and trying to do butterfly poses, right? All the while ignoring the very things that I think are probably going to even make those things easier to achieve, you know, in the first place. So
from the outside, to interrupt you there, I just have to jump in about this one. It's people would argue that, oh, the mobility stuff, it's not hurting you. It's just, you know, it's I'm doing it just to feel good, etc. Great. But your time in the gym is finite. None of us can really work for much longer than 60 minutes, really hard focused. You want the majority of that to be on your muscle building, resistance training stuff. So if you're in there for 20 minutes doing the warm-up, activation, pre-activation, foam rolling stuff, it takes away from that. It will.
Yeah, and I also, I'm a little bit maybe too biased to this extreme, but I'm of the mindset that, like, your training for the, again, barring the circumstances where you're some kind of ballerina, right, who needs to be able to do the splits and put your foot over your head, your training should be your mobility work. Like what is resistance training other than loaded stretching, right? So if you need any kind of convincing argument to sort of lean in the direction of more resistance training, less, you know, flopping around on foam, it would simply be that you are performing stretching motions through specific ranges of motion with more load, right? So you get the mobility benefit, right? You get the flexibility benefit, and you also happen to get all sorts of other things that you know, wouldn't otherwise. So I just think that, especially as people get older, like, much like with these other things, they kind of start to recognize just that time is the biggest constraint of all. or at least hopefully they do. And that over time, people just kind of can integrate these things. And on some level, it's just a matter of understanding, right? It's just understanding like, hey, how do I load these positions that I want to become more mobile in? Right? That is not always super straightforward depending on who you are. So I think the more that we can move toward this sort of resistance training being a kind of panacea, right? I don't love that word, but it really is so all-encompassing in its effects.
Yeah, that whole idea of you need a dedicated mobility, flexibility routine to increase your range of motion isn't 100% true. And the example that I can give is ankle mobility. This is something myself, like many people listening, struggle with. I'd love to be able to get that knee further forward over their toe, more dorsiflexion. And I spent time doing all these dinky little ankle mobility drills, trying to just, you know, pulse forward and back, hold a static stretch just with my body weight, just spending so much time doing it. And I got nowhere. My range of motion didn't increase. It wasn't until I started, okay, I'm going to train my calves seriously twice a week with load, progressing my straight leg calf raise to increase that dorsiflexion. Same thing, throwing in some seated calf raises. What's happening here? We're actually using some resistance. I wasn't doing that before. Coupling that with actually spending time in the squat, which is low load resistance, this combination allowed me to increase my range of motion. And it wasn't some elaborate mobility routine where I'm doing tib ant raises to strengthen the anterior side of the shin. It was just simplicity of resistance, increasing the load, getting stronger, strength at length.
Yeah, it's really amazing what it can do. And I would also say that the bigger, stronger you become, the lower level that those kinds of drills become, right? So it's like if you've just had an ankle surgery, right, and you need to start to increase the range of motion that you've lost, kind of makes sense to just start doing like very sort of subtle, let's say dorsiflexion stretches, right, where you're stretching your calves or what have you, right? But the more that you adapt to those positions, the lower in magnitude those positions become and those exercises become. And eventually it's like, if you're, I mean, especially if you're looking at any trained person, it's like, do you really think that you're going to go from like, you know, we'll say X degrees of dorsiflexion to X plus 5 degrees by using no load? Or do you think that would be probably easier to do by using 200 pounds on a seated calf raise? So again, it's just like, and I'll keep sort of repeating this. It just really becomes a matter of demystifying these concepts to some extent and kind of just bringing things back to a very basic description of the physics of the activities that we're doing.
100%. How about more range of motion is always better for building muscle? More. We've got to go deeper, more stretch, more. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this is something I call the stretch panacea. So it's where everyone believes now, not everyone, right? But many seem to believe that because we have a little bitty, itty bitty amount of research on these, you know, lengthened stretch position exercises, that they're like, it's just like, let's just go balls deep into that direction and let's never return from that direction, right? But then you start to realize like, wait a second, all these people at like the highest levels of muscularity, they seem to be doing a lot of different exercises where they're not getting that kind of deep stretch. Maybe they're getting, they're focused on the squeeze, right? So the Arnold concept is like, getting the squeeze. And we could get into all the sort of nitty gritty nuances, but just at a high level, the way that I look at this is that nothing is more important to muscle growth than not getting hurt. And a lot of times what happens is when people discover, say, new motions where they can get a deeper stretch, a lot of times what they don't realize is the increased amount of stress that comes with those positions, right? So it's like, if we assume that, say, a more stretched exercise would yield more hypertrophy in this sort of one-to-one vacuum, well, that also means that that includes more things everywhere. So it's not just more tension on my quads, let's say, it's actually more patellofemoral compression, right? The for those who don't know, it's like if you picture your patella, right? It's like your patella is that kneecap looking thing, and the space between your patella and your femur, that's the patellofemoral joint. And anytime that your quads have to work harder, right, that joint is also experiencing more stress. So it's like, okay, if I'm going to get this better muscle growth outcome, well, I better be able to manage myself in such a way where that doesn't end up being too costly elsewhere. So for me, it kind of, you know, comes down to what are the range of motions that you're actually comfortable in, and what are the range of motions that, you know, over long periods of time you can sustain in training through. Because again, for me, we go back to just square one here. To grow muscle, to be healthier, to receive any of these benefits that we've been talking about, right? The precondition for that is I'm not in pain and I'm not super hurt. So if taking everything to this sort of stretched extreme, and I've heard this from so many people in my audience, if going to that extreme and just, again, going balls deep in that direction is something that might give you more, you just have to recognize that there are other costs, right? There are no situations, right, at least biologically, that don't come with trade-offs, right? This is why we talk about side effects with drugs, for instance. It's like, you know, this is why there's this laundry list of side effects that, you know, under every commercial. It's like, hey, this, you know, this thing could be good for you, but you might also have diarrhea. You might also get cancer. You might also die. It's like, okay, well, there might be these other trade-offs to these things that we're assuming are just wholly for the good. So just to keep that sort of like concept of the trade-off in mind, and to also understand that there are so many other benefits to, say, training like a more squeezed position. It's kind of like, why wouldn't you want to just get the muscle strong through a multitude of ranges? So it just kind of makes sense intuitively. I want to be strong when my arm is, you know, up here over my head, but I also want to be strong with my arm down by my side. And so my approach to training and programming generally is just, I want to make sure that I'm checking either one of those boxes. And in doing so, I want to make sure that I'm not at any point compromising any kind of joint integrity, you know, whether it be knee, elbow, hip, because ultimately I do think that ends up being the rate limiter for people. Doesn't end up being like, oh, this exercise didn't promote, you know, enough growth for me in this moment.
What you're also sacrificing if you're using as deep range of motion as you possibly can is load, weight. You have to sacrifice that. And you'd think that doing that extreme range of motion, if you have to really reduce your loads by 25% or even more, that's a lot of less mechanical tension on the muscle too.
Yeah. So I certainly can get on board with that idea as well. And also just the idea that, like, you know, let's rewind back to the bench press, right? if you are at the poor starting place of thinking that you have to do the bench press, right? It would be worse in that context to assume that you would have to touch the bar to your chest, right? It's like, why did we randomly decide that that was like the end all be all of an effective bench press? It's like, unless I touch my chest, therefore, you know, all this exercise was wasted. That has never made sense to me. But what that range of motion might actually entail is a kind of compromise in terms of not only the load, as you're saying, potentially, but also like what is doing the moving, right? So a lot of times we're really heavily focused on implement range of motion. In other words, how far is this barbell moving? How deep am I getting in my squat? How much is the leg press sled moving? Right? But ultimately what we care about is how much are our joints moving, and are the joints that I'm trying to train, you know, the muscles that I'm trying to train that are surround the joints, are those things going to be the things that I'm training? So just to finish off with the bench press example, it's like, well, you might lower to a point where all that motion is coming from retraction of your shoulder blades, right? Extension of your humeruses, your humeri, your arms backward. And then you might get to a point where your shoulders just kind of are doing this sort of slumping thing to get forward, right? And it's not as if all of a sudden that's a death sentence for your shoulder or anything like that, but it's just like the muscles that we're trying to train, they don't control that action, right? That is an action that is being born of you thinking that this external thing moving is the most important thing. So I would just say that whenever we're talking about range, it's like, okay, the joint and the joint structures, they come first, and then it's a concern about muscle, and then it's a concern about implement if we're concerned about it at all.
And that was a great distinction for people listening, because at the surface, they just look at the range of motion in the movement itself, but not actually looking at what their body is doing. I love that bench press example of the shoulders dumping forward. And the other one comes to mind is someone is forcing themselves to do a deficit deadlift, and they're trying to go with this whole maximum range of motion concept, and they begin to flex the lumbar spine excessively, well beyond their active muscular range of the posterior chain. This more range of motion, movement pattern, is coming at the expense of the tension on the muscles. So you're getting more range, but it's not actually doing that much for the muscles. Would that be a correct thought process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great example. Another one that comes to mind is, you know, let's say you're doing like a hip dominant leg press, like for glutes, right? So maybe your feet are a little bit higher. You assume that just like smushing your knees into your eyeballs is the thing that you need to do. Meanwhile, it's like, okay, halfway down the range of motion, my ass just lifted like 10 feet off of the pad. And all of that motion is being controlled by spinal erectors, right? From basically from the opposite direction. So I always think it just comes down to, again, this understanding that no, the ignorance, it's not bliss really in any scenario, especially when you're someone who's doing that across every movement that you do. So it's like, okay, every time you thought you were training your quads and your glutes and your adductors, you were actually, you know, getting a 4 out of 10 stimulus to your erectors. And then people walk around wondering, it's why, you know, they finish their leg session. And it's like, why does it feel like my back is much more fatigued than my legs?
You know? How was your leg day, bro? Oh man, my joints cook, hips, spine. Is that the correct thing? Is that what I should be feeling?
Yeah, that's another thing too that connects to the whole rite of passage thing of like just feeling destroyed. Like if I come out of my leg day and non-leg things are tired, it's like, okay, I'm gonna wave the red flag around and try to do something different next time.
Ben, if you didn't puke and that wasn't captured on video, you're not an actual fitness influencer.
Yeah. I can safely say, dude, that I have never puked in a resistance training session, and I hope to never puke in a resistance training session.
I have never puked, but I've been borderline fainting at the end of a session. It was a time when I had to fast before a workout. It was like a 35 degree day in Melbourne, Australia. I got into a workout and it was just humid, hot, sweaty. I probably wasn't hydrated enough, poor electrolytes and stuff. I got towards the end of the workout and I needed one of my mates just to come over and keep me upright, give me a Powerade. So that wasn't hardcore. That is just poor management of nutrition and the conditions of the day.
Yeah, there is also no more clear sign that you have done something that you should not have done than throwing up your food. Like, think about how evolutionarily problematic that would be, right? It's like to throw up is to remove these calories to some degree, right? To some degree that you've just consumed. It's like there's no clearer sign that you've just sort of lost the thread.
Or fainting, someone can just come and just like eat you or take advantage of you or something. Okay, how about using wrist straps to lift is cheating? It's a sign that your forearms are weak and you shouldn't use straps on back day.
Mm. Yeah, the parallel I always give here is, well, if straps are cheating, what is that really kind of in an analogy, what is that saying? Well, it's basically saying that using a tool to more specifically accomplish a goal is cheating, okay? So at that point, we should just throw away every machine. We should throw away every dumbbell. We should throw away our shoes, you know, because wearing shoes to accomplish the goal of not stepping on glass when I walk outside, right? That's cheating. It may seem like it is funny to me, may seem like a somewhat silly analogy, but I do think that there is a very close parallel in that, much like, you know, with all these barbell concepts and these attachments to these old ideas, it's like for whatever reason, we seem to have this strong resistance to using things that make it easier for us to accomplish the goal, right? So I'll give you a kind of parallel here that will hopefully make sense. And let me know if it does make sense, because if it doesn't make sense to you, it might not make sense to anyone, which is, you know, think about the concept of like creating stability in exercise. So if I am going to do a, let's say a biceps curl, right? is it cheating for me to put my elbow or my, you know, the lower part of my arm up against something? Right? It's like a preacher curl, for instance, right? The example you gave earlier was like, we don't tend to, you know, hold our arm out there and do the curl because we know that, like, you know, you would experience a lot of shoulder fatigue just trying to hold your arms up while you do a preacher curl. So is that cheating, or are we just taking advantage of modern equipment to more easily accomplish what we're trying to do? And in my estimation, broadly speaking, we should try to pick exercises that make it as easy as possible to do what we're trying to do, right? So that we can actually go as hard in those vectors as we possibly can. And if I'm trying to train my hips, right, my glutes, my hamstrings, my adductors, I don't want to be limited by my grip. And who gets to decide what a strong and a weak grip is, right? If I'm doing RDLs with four plates, does that mean that I should be able to hold four plates, right, compared to someone who's maybe using half that load? It's like just the arbitrary standard is an idea, broadly speaking, is a concept, broadly speaking, that just seems to infest all of these different things in a really like insidious way, in a really harmful way, right? Because again, people become captured by the idea and then they're just not able to do what they're trying to do because, again, you know, straps equals bad. So does that parallel kind of add up?
Makes sense. I would say that using straps would be cheating if you use the straps to lift the same load that you can handle unstrapped, because it's easier. It's the same load that you're using, but we're not using straps in that respect. We're always using straps to lift more weight as well as train harder. We can use this example in so many cases, but you pick a row, say it's a machine row. With the straps, you're able to lift heavier. You're able to do a more prolonged eccentric before your grip gives out. That's just straight up the way it is.
Yeah, and you know, if you're thinking about a machine row too, it's like if you think that using straps is cheating, well then we should just get rid of the chest support too, right? Because the chest support might be cheating as well, you know, through that framework. When in reality, it's like, no. It's just this physical thing we're taking advantage of so that we can train rowing stuff instead of having to, you know, hold ourselves up with spinal erectors or quads, depending on where our feet are.
Where do you think that comes in, the whole weak grip situation? How does that even matter when it comes to accomplishing our goals in the gym?
Well, I think it may relate to this overall concept. If you've heard of the idea, which I'm sure you have, that like grip is associated with longevity now, and longevity now is like the buzzword of all buzzwords in the modern day. And so I think that it also doesn't make sense on a different level, because it's not like when you use straps that all of a sudden your forearm muscles just like flick off like a light switch. Like if you're using straps, you still have to hold the strap to the thing. And I have literally never encountered a situation, back to the daily life thing, where my grip has been the limiting factor in anything, right? Maybe if I'm carrying a box from Amazon all the way across my apartment complex, it's like, all right, maybe my grip's a little bit tired. But grip is just one of those things, you know, much like the muscles of the low back, let's say, that is so intimately involved in everything that you do, right? That your grip is getting stimulus all the time, right? Just simply picking up plates and putting them on machines. It's like the quantity of times that you do that in a given session, people don't really tend to think about that, right? But when you look at, say, people who are resistance trained for long periods of time, they have large amounts of muscle, you don't see people who use straps all of a sudden just have forearms that are totally disproportionate to the rest of their body. It's not like your forearm just suddenly falls off your body and becomes this pencil chopstick looking thing, right? It's just like those things are constantly involved with all these tasks that we do. So where exactly it comes from, that in particular is beyond my scope to speculate, much in the same way that all this other stuff is in some ways confusing when we take a step back just to kind of think about it more closely. But I certainly think that, you know, if you're someone who's really hell bent on not using straps, go ahead, you know, do it if you want to do it. But just recognize that the back gains may suffer as a consequence.
I think so too. What about this 2-to-1 pull to push ratio? The fact that you should be doing twice as many pulling exercises relative to pushing to promote structural balance as well as to prevent pain and injury. This whole muscle imbalance type of concept.
So this is actually a really interesting segue, because I do actually have maybe a hypothesis as to why this became a thing initially. If you think about most pulling exercises, you know, just your traditional pulling exercises, right? Most, you know, your cable pull downs, your pull ups, your dumbbell rows, your cable rows, your barbell rows, all those exercises are exercises that are relatively more challenging at shorter muscle lengths, right? Whereas most traditional pressing movements tend to be challenging, you know, say dumbbell press, Smith machine press, barbell press, you know, pick your poison. Those are movements that tend to be more challenging in the stretch, right? So if we think about on a per rep basis, which generates more fatigue, right? On a, just a, again, a traditional level, people tend to be able to fatigue their pushers, right? Their, all the different portions of their pecs, right? Their front portion of the delts. People tend to fatigue those very, very easily and fairly effortlessly. But to do the same thing in pulling exercises requires a kind of understanding of things like resistance profiles, of things like muscle length and how muscle length relates to internal tension production capability. So I think that what has happened overall is people have recognized that more volume needs to be allocated when we're dealing with muscle groups that tend to be trained with shorter position things, and less volume needs to be allocated toward things like pressing movements, or common pressing movements, traditional pressing movements, which again tend to bias that stretch position. So, you know, at bottom, I can actually understand, unlike the other things, why this, you know, came to be a phenomenon. Not to mention the fact that, like, there are just so many different muscles on your back compared to your compared to your front, right? It's like we got the pecs, we got the front delts, versus we got, you know, the lats and the lower lats, the middle lats, the upper lats. We have the traps, all the different divisions of those. We have the different divisions of the rear delts and the rhomboids. The list goes on. So in some sense, I get it. But in another sense, right, to imagine that there needs to be some kind of structural balance in the system, as if we could ever balance that amount of muscle mass on the back versus that amount of muscle mass in the front, it's just kind of a non-starter to me. So I think that ultimately that is myth at that level. But on a practical level, I'm kind of like, well, overall, it probably takes more pulling exercises than pushing exercises to, you know, develop the overall back versus the overall front. But it's certainly not a 2-to-1 ratio. And it certainly doesn't have to be for you to see equivalent progress from back to front.
That was a really cool theory, Ben, there. I like how you broke that down in terms of the difficulty of the movement pushing compared to pulling, as well as the different amount of muscle mass that we're dealing with. From a physiotherapy background, this myth tends to get perpetuated based on what are all those postural exercises you should be doing for your back to, you know, increase the strength of your mid back, as well as undo the rounded shoulders that happen from all the pressing of the pecs and anterior deltoids. But to my knowledge, there isn't strong research actually proving this 2-to-1 ratio. It was just some arbitrary metric that was made by certain strength conditioning coaches, rehab people, and it's just been promoted without any actual real rationale behind it.
Yeah, it's very akin to the whole story around posture altogether, right? And the whole posture myths that we are currently dealing with and that are currently popular kind of fall for a similar trap. And, you know, many of these things, you know, specifically, if you've ever heard of upper cross syndrome.
Oh yeah, man, this was a classic idea.
It's like, for those who don't know, upper cross syndrome is kind of like the classic posture you were just describing. It's like when people have this sort of, you know, I mean, people conflate it with other things, but it's basically what many people would recognize as quote unquote poor posture, which was all born of basically nothing that was actually had a firm scientific bedrock, but which was born of someone who was a physio in maybe, I want to say, the 1950s, 60s, I could be getting that wrong, who basically like had a theory And then people jumped on the theory. And like all theories, it's like you can see results from any number of different things for a whole bunch of reasons that are completely beyond the scope of the actual framework itself. So to make that a little more concrete, it's like, okay, if I am constantly, you know, in this like slumped forward posture for 10 hours a day typing at my desk, it's obvious why, you know, arching my back might feel better, right? In the same way that if I sit in a chair for just 5 minutes and I try to sit still, right, that is eventually going to be uncomfortable. It's not the position, right? It's the dose. And with all these things, it's like the devil is in the dose to me. Not to mention the fact that I have also never seen anyone go from quote unquote poor posture to quote unquote bad posture or the inverse. Like, I just don't see people changing structurally that way. I just see people who are less muscular and who are more muscular. And generally speaking, the solution to these things seems to just be, all right, just, you know, get more muscular and things will go better.
Yeah, it's this coming in and seeing people that are kyphotic, you know, hunchback in the thoracic, forward neck, and they're experiencing symptoms and saying that because they look like this, they're getting that pain. But it's not a one-to-one in that respect, because we have people with poor posture who can go their whole life living completely fine, pain-free, being strong, being mobile. But it just, the most simple way I can wrap that up with the whole posture thing is just what you said. You stick to any posture for an extended period of time, it's going to be painful. The perfect posture, military, upright, standing, chin tucked, scaps retracted, that's going to absolutely cook you and be painful.
Yeah. It's like, okay, see how long you can do that. Just like hold that position, just chill there, you know?
I'd give someone, after even like 1.5 minutes, you start to just slowly return back to your default.
Yeah. And it's also like something that I think many people don't know is that your thoracic spine, right, which is basically most of what looks like the spine to people, it's like there are 12 of those segments, has a natural kyphotic curve, right? So it's like your mid to upper back is supposed to be like a little bit of a turtle shell, right? That is at bottom like what a person is. It's like this S-shaped spine thing. So part of it is certainly just a lack of understanding of, you know, scientific inquiry and the whole correlation causation story. But another part of it certainly is just understanding like what normal humans are structured like.
Warm-ups, they tend to be quite misunderstood. There's an element of fitness professionals that recommend you need to do extended activation exercises for the muscles involved before you do your lifting. Is this true or false?
I would say it's false in terms of necessity. And a really simple sort of concrete way to think about this would be, you know, pick the most common version of this, which might be glute activation, right? It's like, let's think through this. I'm going to do exercises that train my glutes today. So hopefully those are exercises which activate my glutes, right? So why would it be necessary to activate my glutes before doing the thing that is therefore supposed to activate my glutes and grow my glutes?
It's the mind-muscle connection myth that you have to be feeling the muscle working during the compound exercise. But what we discussed today, if you're doing the squat pattern or some type of hinge pattern, you're going to be working those glutes. It's just, unless you have some type of neurological condition where the innervation to that muscle group has been turned off, you'll be fine.
Yeah, and I also think that if people want to maybe have those stronger sensations to like, okay, know that, hey, this is a thing that's going to train the muscle that I, you know, if for whatever reason you're like a neurotic person, you just need it. Just do any kind of exercise for that muscle in a shorter muscle length, right? So start with a hip thrust, start with a glute kickback, right? There are so many things where if you get into that short position, right, much like, you know, the biceps sort of squeeze thing, anytime you get to a shortest possible muscle length of any tissue, you're going to feel that tissue more. So if you want to do any warm up for an exercise like squats that is not a squat, right, just do a different exercise for, say, the glutes, like a hip thrust, that can kind of grease the groove in a way that actually makes sense. And in an exercise context where you can actually progress that exercise over time, you know, unlike these, you know, clamshells and single leg bridges. And it's not that I could never see application for that stuff. It's just like 90%+ of the time, it's just people who are doing exercises that, like you said, are not supposed to, by definition, include that much sensation, or who are doing exercises that don't at all make a rate limiter of the muscle they're trying to target. So to me, it all just comes back to this idea of make sure that the physics are appropriate, and you don't have to spend a bunch of time wondering, you know, about whether your glutes, when you walked in the door, you know, had the on switch or had the off switch.
To me, it's about focusing on what matters most for your progress. A warm-up that is sound to me would be 5 to 10 minutes, general warm-up, full body. It could be walking as an example, and then just doing a few progressively heavier sets on the exercise that you want to do before your top set. That's probably the most optimal workout. I don't like using that word, because who's to say a couple activations won't kill you? It won't, but it's just these little things. If you take your training really seriously and you want to focus on what matters most, that'd be my warm-up recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, today I trained chest today, and my first exercise was pec deck. So what I did was I sat down on the pec deck and I put a random light weight on there, did like 10, 15 reps. I put a random slightly heavier weight on there, 10, 15 reps, did a random heavier, you know, and then eventually it's like, okay, I arrived at what I knew was going to be my working weight. And alas, you know, 2 minutes later, I was at my first set of the deck.
Yeah. And that's, I'm ashamed to say, something that I only started doing maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And I've been lifting for 15 years. And it's almost this curse sometimes of the more knowledge that you have can be to your detriment. You think that these niche activation exercises for your quote unquote stabilizers in the movement are going to really help you push the needle forward. But before I knew it, my pre-warm-up routine of mobility and activation, it's like 15, 20 minutes. And it didn't really help me. If anything, it just took energy and time away from the actual workout. It's a way of masquerading effort. I'll say it because no one else wants to say it. You often spend time in this warm-up so that you don't have to just start doing the hard shit for the day.
Yeah, and I suppose when you enjoy the hard shit, you kind of want to get to it sooner. And again, it's just like it ties into this whole mindset that, you know, there are certain things that we must do, that we need to do, that historically have been, quote, true, you know, because XYZ person said it. And it's just like, I would really like to encourage people to ask themselves the question of, is this my belief, or like, is this a belief that has been thrust upon me, you know, by the industry or by a particular person? And if it's not your belief, you know, it makes sense to me to ask yourself sort of where that's coming from and whether or not it is actually true.
Agreed. How about doing special exercises that train all of those little stabilizer muscles?
Did you see that I was talking about this recently? Because this has been...
I may or may not have done my research prior to this podcast, Ben.
Okay, fair enough. Fair game. Yeah, I mean, I won't name names, but I recently heard someone say that, you know, if you spend a lot of time on machines, you might just get off the machine and collapse, or crumble maybe was the word that he happened to have used. Yeah, it was, he was either collapse or crumble, or no, he said get crushed. And I was thinking to myself, well, what would you get crushed by, you know, like getting off of a chest press machine?
Gravity will get you, Ben.
I guess so. I mean, much like all these other things, I think we just need to strip everything down to the most basic level, which is that regardless of what muscle we're talking about, however big, however small, whatever joints it happens to cross, right? All muscles do is they pull points together, right? So two or more bones they attach to, and they contract, right? So my biceps, you know, they two of them, right? Both of them attached to my shoulder blade. They contract and pull my shoulder blade downward, and they pull my forearm upward. That's all that they do. And whether or not we call a muscle a stabilizer, to me, is always just related to the context, right? So people typically think of say a muscle like the pecs, right, the chest, as like a prime mover, a quote unquote prime mover muscle. And you know, we might do things like chest flies or bench presses, and in that context, sure, it's a, you know, it's the thing that's doing the moving, no problem. But you know, go to any other exercise. You know, say we're doing some kind of triceps pushdown, is an example I use a lot. Well, your pecs, specifically the lower portions of your pecs, they actually need to prevent your shoulders from shrugging up if you're trying to push something downward. Right. So in context A, they were doing the moving, they were performing the bench press. But in context B, they were stabilizing the movement, they were preventing motion from occurring. So to me, it's kind of, again, this claim that to me is a non-starter, where it's like any muscle given any change in position, change in exercise could be a stabilizer, and or it could be a prime mover, right? If we accept those terms. And even in context where we're talking about muscles like the rotator cuff, say, it's like, do you imagine that your rotator cuff is not doing anything in a bench press? Do you imagine that, you know, when you go from a dumbbell press to a machine press, that all of a sudden your, you know, let's just say subscapularis in this context, because it makes more sense. Do you imagine that muscle is just all of a sudden going to not perform its function? And if it's not going to perform its function, how do we determine that? You know, how is it that you're measuring that? It's like all these questions are, of course, don't have logical, rational answers, because the sort of starting point for them is all just a host of assumptions that to me have never made sense and certainly don't now. But you know, between you and I, Daniel, I would love for someone to present a really strong evidence-based case that like the whole stabilizer thing is more important than we believe, because then it would mean that I would learn something new. You know?
Definitely. There's a lot of gray area in terms of the definitions and whatnot, especially if you take a basic anatomy biomechanics course in, say, do exercise science. You hear there's agonists, antagonists, there's neutralizers, there's stabilizers, there's all these different things based on the movement itself. And I really like that rotator cuff example, because people think rotator cuff, they injure their shoulder, they go to see a physio, they do external rotation, they might do some internal rotation, but we forget how the rotator cuff functions as a whole during our actual exercise. So if we're doing any movement where we're flexing our shoulder, lifting our arm up overhead, the back of the cuff is going to be working to help keep that glenohumeral joint stable. If you're going into an extension-based movement, it's that anterior cuff is going to be working. So just expanding on that, just not that simplistic notion of your rotator cuff is just doing external rotation, it's actually contributing to support the prime movers in those exercises.
Yeah, and if anyone wants a sort of clear visual of this, you could just Google rotator cuff. And the cool thing about the rotator cuff in particular is that it is basically just a shoulder blade that is made of muscle, right? It's basically just a group of muscles that gives the shoulder blade a nice hug, right? And basically what it does is it just holds the ball in the socket. So anytime that you're moving anywhere, lateral raise, push up, pull up, press, row, whatever it happens to be, it's like, unless those tissues are appropriately contracting, right? You've got a problem on your hands if not. So, you know, again, much like all these sort of physics-based conversations, I don't have to talk to my rotator cuff and ask it whether or not it is going to turn on for a bench press. I just know that if my shoulder is doing okay, then it is appropriately doing its job. And you know, if we never have to, you know, in a kind of weird sense, it's like we don't seem to have the same assumptions about something like the rotator cuff as we do the glutes. It's like, how many people would like to be feeling their rotator cuff like during a bench press? It's like, to me, it is a sign of appropriate function that in a bench press, we feel our chest, right? We feel our triceps, and we don't feel stuff kind of buried in there. So overall, just to put a sort of final note on that, I totally get from a colloquial standpoint why people use the terms a stabilizer, prime mover. It makes sense, but it only makes sense insofar as we actually understand the physics of what is occurring. It doesn't make sense on this level of mystical, magical exercise concepts.
Definitely. And the confusion comes in when we're talking about stabilizer muscles versus instability in an exercise. For example, if you're doing ring dips, ring pull-ups, your hands are moving around in space as you're doing the exercise. There's instability by virtue of the equipment, but there's not really stabilizer muscles during the exercise.
Yeah, that's a really, really good distinction. And the way that I kind of like to think about that, again, goes back to this, all muscles are stabilizers concept. So even if we looked at the pecs, let's say, and even if we didn't look at the pecs across multiple contexts, bench press to triceps extension was the example I used, you know, whenever the pecs contract, right, they're pulling the arm, but they're also actually creating a kind of joint compression that that holds the joint together. And every single muscle does that just as an intrinsic property of contraction. It's like contraction is stability. Those two things are synonymous to me. So really important distinction that you made in that there is a difference between this internal stability, i.e. to me, a concrete way to say that is our joints are held together appropriately, versus how wobbly is this thing that I'm standing on, or how wobbly are these rings that I'm holding? And that to me is actually a totally separate conversation, one that gets conflated with this one, which is just what is your skill in the thing, right? And like getting better at the thing makes you appear less wobbly. That doesn't mean that that thing in and of itself is training internal stability more than these other exercises that you're loading five times as much.
Ben, I want to bring it home with some optimism. I want you to explain, how can we choose the correct exercises? What are the principles and concepts, the green flags of what make an exercise a good choice?
So beyond a deep understanding of the concepts, because I recognize that most people are not interested in spending, you know, half their days learning about torque and, you know, the translatory motion and linear and all these jargony things, I think that the first and most important thing to consider is just everything from like a joint perspective. So I really focus, especially with people who talk to me, who are kind of not like deep in the fitness space about exercise, or it's just family members or just friends who are not super into exercise. I try to take the conversation in the direction of, rather than quads, you know, something more like knees. Right. Rather than chest, something more like shoulders, shoulders in a, from a joint perspective, not, you know, the deltoid perspective. And that is a starting point to me. Again, connects back to this overall conversation about not getting hurt being the primary thing. Right. Because the joints are the bedrock. The muscles are kind of the fancy things that that we like to talk about and grow on top of the bedrock. So for me, it's a matter of, okay, do we have an exercise, at least one or two, again, if you're just someone who's kind of generally into fitness, that involves motion at this or that joint? So, you know, am I doing something where I'm moving my knee forward or my shin forward, you know, at my knee, like a leg extension? Am I doing something where I'm doing the opposite motion? Am I doing a curl, like a biceps thing, or am I doing a triceps extension? So I think about the joint first, and I think, okay, am I moving the joint in multiple directions? So that's kind of like my starting point. And as long as I'm doing exercises that involve training all the joints in my body, then by definition, I've covered all of the sort of muscular concerns that I might have, right? So again, take something more complicated like the shoulder. Am I moving the shoulder forward against resistance? Am I pulling on something with resistance? Am I maybe doing something pressing upward? Am I pulling with something downward, right? And this kind of translates nicely into the whole classic model of, do I do a push? Do I do a pull that's horizontal? Do I do a push and a pull that's vertical? Do I do a curl? Do I do an extension, you know, at both my elbows and my knees? And, you know, bada bing, bada boom, you've got a fantastic program, right, on your hands. And I think that for a vast, vast majority of people, that's kind of like, it's going to cover 95% of what people are actually looking for in exercise. And as long as those selections make sense in terms of they feel good, I can add weight to them over time and I can sustain them, you know, that's that to me is a formula for success, all assuming that you actually, at least to some degree, enjoy what you're doing and don't hate what you're doing. And the reason that I love that joint first approach is because it's very freeing, right? It's not barbell squat. It's just squatting kind of thing, you know? It's not barbell deadlift or barbell bench. It's pressing, pulling kind of thing. And I think that, again, the more freedom, the more options we present to people, the more that they can just play around with things and recognize that there aren't any, you know, right answers on a very generalized level, and that there are so many ways to do this thing we call resistance training and to make progress, that to constrain yourself to one selection or another, again, is synonymous with or is akin to, you know, constraining yourself to one or two or three foods, right? It doesn't make sense now. And it's certainly not going to make sense 10 weeks from now when you're shoveling chicken down your throat because you think it's the only thing that you should eat.
Ben Yanes, I appreciate your time, mate. Your positivity, your ability to simplify advanced concepts, you know, talking about principles instead of people. I think you're doing great work for the fitness industry, mate. Where can people find out more about your stuff if they want to learn more?
On Instagram is great. On YouTube, I've been going a little bit harder on the YouTube game, just my name on either one of those platforms, and everything else you can kind of find through there. And I really appreciate the conversation. Would love to do it again if you had a decent time, and appreciate you having me on.
No worries, mate. If you guys want to see a 2-hour quad video, Ben Yanes has you covered on his YouTube. So you can check that out if you want to geek out.
Awesome, man.
Awesome. Take care, mate.
If you enjoyed the conversation, leave a rating on the Fitness FAQs podcast to support the show. See you next episode.